If this is your land, where are your stories? With these words, a tribal elder defended his people against the grasp of state officials in British Columbia. He invoked a uniquely human quality, our ability to derive a sense of belonging through oral tradition, to create relationships with place through story. My grandfather told me a story. He told it in the dark of his forge and beside his hearth and in his garden as we pulled rhubarb. It was his truth, a part of him, which he passed on. There's a farmer living down Moberly, and he has him a white mare. And he must go take this mare and sell her at Macclesfield Market. So off he sets one day at the back end of October, and he gets to Thieves Hole just as it's coming light. The mare stops, and will she shift herself? She will not. Choose what he does. And there, against the side of the road, he sees a tall old chap, thin as a rasher of wind, and he's got a proper sort of a stick in his hand. "Oh," he says, this chap, "that's just the mare I'm after. How much do you want for her?" "I'm not selling to the likes of you," says farmer. "I'll get more at market." "You go your ways," says the old chap. "You'll not sell her, and I'll be waiting for you tonight." So off rides farmer to market, and he stands market all day long. But though everybody says she's a grand beast, no one offers to buy that mare. And at finish, he has to get him back to Moberly with her. When he comes to Thieves' Hole, it's fetching night, and there's the old chap waiting for him. "Now will you sell?" he says. "How much will you give?" says farmer. "Enough," he says. "You come with me." And off he tramps with farmer behind him. They go from Thieves' Hole by Seven Firs and Goldenstone to Stormy Point and Saddlebow. And on Saddlebow, they come to a rock, because our house nearly. And the old chap touches the rock with his stick, and the rock splits open, clatter. And behind the rock there's some iron gates. He touches them with his stick, and they open, and there's a sort of a hole into the hill. By this time, farmer, he's asking the old chap to let him go and keep the mare. He wants no money for her. But the old chap tells him he'll not come to no harm, he says. So farmer takes the mare down into the hill after him. They come to a cave, and it's full of knights in armour, snoring, and a king with them, and their heads against a white horse each. Except one. "All this year," says the old chap, "is a sleeping army with their top man, waiting on the last battle of the world, and whenever that day is, I must wake them. But I'm one horse short, and yours will do nicely. Now you come with me." And he takes farmer to another cave, and this one is full of gold and silver and all sorts. "Have as much as you can carry," he says, "and we'll call that payment." Well, farmer, he sets to and he crams his boots and his pockets, his breeches and his shirts with treasure and his hat. And when he can hold no more, the old chap takes him back to the iron gates and shoves him through. Another clatter and a bang, and when Farmer turns him round, there's just the rock. And it's black as a bag outside. Well, Farmer, he gets home as best he may and tells his tale. And the next morning, him and his neighbours, they go back to fetch more treasure. But neither they nor any since have seen the iron gates again. That's the story my grandfather told, and it's the legend of Alderley. Alderley Edge, in geological terms, is a Permo-Triassic galena chalcopyrite and barite mineralized multifaulted horst rising from the eastern aspect of the Cheshire Plain, which is spectacular. But today, we're in search of a different spectacle, story. My grandfather did not know, and would not have cared if he had known, that the legend is a version of the myth of the sleeping hero, which is distributed widely in space and time. Incidents differ, but at their most simple and comprehensive, the stories involve the encounter of a mortal with an immortal asleep under the ground. Here I should say what is meant by legend. The technical definition of a legend is a fanciful story associated with a place and believed to be true by the people that live there. I remember as a child during World War II listening to adults joking, yet only half joking, that if the knights were ever going to wake, now was the time, but they would need white tanks, not white horses. The story fulfilled the definition of a legend. Legend is oral. When it's hijacked by those that do not believe it and make the vernacular polite, quaint, romantic, and trivial, then the importance, the memory, and the truth are lost, as a printed example of 1820 shows. The introduction declares its hand. This tradition was long held in high estimation and credence by the peasantry of Alderley. And although the belief in enchantment is extinguished by the gentle but sure flow of religious instruction, yet there are many who would take pleasure in reading the tale of the powerful wizard who once held sway in the very place they now inhabit, the farmer. "Nay, tell me more," the sestrian cried. "Why are these steeds in order tied? Why are those men all bright in arms, and why prepared for war's alarms? Say, are they doomed to mortal toil, or destined to unearthly broil?" On this the wizard changed his face, assumed a mild and brighter grace, and to his tone was something given as from a messenger from heaven. "These are the caverned troops by fate foredoomed, the guardians of our state. England's good genius here detains the armed defenders of her plains, doomed to remain till that fell day when foemen marshalled in array and feud's intestine shall combine to seal the ruin of our line." Against this, John Maruskin stands by my grandfather with his essay Listening to the Printed Text. It is in the speech of carters and housewives, in the speech of blacksmiths and old women, that one discovers the magic that sings the claim of the voice in the shadow, or that chants the rhyme of the fish in the well. Plutarch, in his book Concerning the Failure of Oracles, written in the 1st century AD, quotes the report of Demetrios, who had been sent from Rome to gather information about the islands of Britain. "There is," men said, "an island in which Kronos is imprisoned, with Briareus keeping guard over him as he sleeps. For, as they put it, sleep is the bond forged for Kronos. They add that around him are many divine beings, his knights and his soldiers." Now, I'm not suggesting that Plutarch is referring to Alderley. What I am saying is that the story existed in this part of Europe in the Iron Age. And the question is, why, when, and how did the legend begin its journey to me through my grandfather's mouth and that of the Edge? Legend, I've found, can be, in its origins, an attempt to retain, perhaps to explain, a reality. News that time has warped, a game of Chinese whispers passed from generation to generation until the meaning may be lost, but the elements remain. So, how may we find them without floundering in subjectivity? By the time I was 18, I'd learnt an important rule of research. Pursue the anomaly. If something doesn't make sense, what is it saying? Anomalies are in the truth my grandfather told me about the land he knew best. The first, which should have been obvious to my grandfather, who was brought up to work with horses, is that it's irrational for a farmer wishing to show off his mare to lead her more than 12 miles over bad terrain involving a climb of 400 feet, when by waiting a week he could have sold her at Knutsford Horse Fair, less than 3 miles away on level ground. The next anomaly is the start of the quest. The old man stops the farmer at a place on the edge called Thieves' Hole. To get to where the old man opens the way to the cavern at a rock known as the Iron Gates, the farmer is led from Thieves' Hole by Seven Firs and Golden Stone to Stormy Point and Saddle Bowl. That is impractical. And we work from the bottom. Until the 18th century, the edge was an open heath. The woods that we see now are the result of landscaping. Why then did the old man traipse the farmer across the heath in a zigzag, which increased the journey by more than 20%. What truth was my grandfather telling about the land he knew best? I went to look for the why and the what. And in trying to answer these questions, I set out on a journey no less mysterious than the farmer's. It was a journey into the land. And the land was itself the telling of a story, the narration of a tale that followed a path and took its line from waymarkers, as the legend does. At each of the named places on the route from Thieves' Hole to the Iron Gates, I came upon peculiarities in the forms of mounds, big stones, and above all, boundaries. I was confronted by something old. The places mattered to my grandfather, and since place names in England tend to be early, when names described what was then seen as fact, here was where to start to look. I began to question the names. The old man stops the farmer at Thieves' Hole. Old English theof is thief. Old English hol means valley, depression, or hollow way. Thieves' Hole is just such a hollow way. Not a hole in the modern sense, but a linear earthwork. It could be both way and boundary. They're often one and the same. It's not a border of any existing land division now, but it could have been used as such, whatever its original purpose, in the Middle Ages for an estate now lost. A charter of 1008 from Rolston, Staffordshire, describes one of the meres or mark points of a boundary as Than thorna ver the theophus lishkath, to the thorn where the thieves lie. And at Whitney, Oxfordshire, in 1044, there occurs of Akenas felder ver the knithus lishkath, from Akensfield where the lads lie. The Old English verb, lichken, means to lie, not in wait, but as a corpse. It indicates a place of execution and or burial. And for this purpose, the Anglo-Saxons came to favour boundaries. It wasn't always so. Anglo-Saxon initial attitudes to boundaries showed more a sense of the divine than of dread. But with the introduction of Christianity, there was a movement from pagan respect to God-goaded fear. From Thieves' Hole by Seven Firs and Goldenstone to Stormy Point and Saddle Bowl. One of the enigmas of the Edge is the occurrence of six flat-top mounds of no known age or purpose. They could be prehistoric burials. They could be romantic additions by the aristocratic Stanleys for their new-planted woodland. They could be both, or almost anything. With one exception, they have no name. But the route from Thieves' Hole to Saddle Bowl takes in three of them, including the exception, which is called Seven Firs. A geophysical survey here has recorded seven discrete signals, which could be the remains of tree roots. Only excavation would answer the question of what these circular features are, but it was common in the 18th century for landscapes to be improved by the planting of clumps on old bumps. From Thieves' Hole by Seven Firs and Goldenstone to Stormy Point and Saddle Bowl, the earliest surviving mention of Goldenstone is in a perambulation of the boundaries of Over Alderley and Nether Alderley in 1598. And so to a great stone called the Golden Stone on the north side of the Wayne Way. Golden Stone is a freestanding block of conglomerate sandstone, notable for its content of white quartz pebbles. It seems to have been shaped by battering, that is, not with metal tools. And it's not golden, It's grey. It weighs about 12 tons and was brought from a distance when there was plenty of other stone nearby. This, together with the nature of its tooling, is consistent with a prehistoric origin for its placement. But why is a grey stone called golden? We need to look at language again. In place names, Old English yildan can mean several things. Gold-coloured, plainly not the case here. Sacrifice, tribute, tax, treasure, wealthy, splendid. I intuitively reject sacrifice and tend towards tribute. A boundary is neutral, a symbolic place for the transfer of wealth, since when it's at the boundary, the tribute is nowhere and can belong to no one. Behind Golden Stone is the second flat-topped mound. From Thieves' Hole by Seven Fires and Golden Stone to Stormy Point and Saddle Bowl, the route from Golden Stone to Stormy Point parts over and never Alderley. As it reaches Stormy Point, it touches the third flat-topped mound. Old English stormy is stormy. Middle English from Old French point is a place, a spot. There's a lot going on here. There's the devil's grave. An artificial chamber entered by a trench that runs down one side. It's unique on the edge. And as at Golden Stone, there's no sign of metal tooling. Devil is used frequently in the naming of strangeness, especially of early works in the landscape. The sense is that they are other, unsafe, things from long ago, and a different kind of time. Also, naming and renaming matters where places or things are already recognised, have meaning, and need to be dealt with, which is often done by demonisation of prehistoric remains at the time of conversion from paganism to Christianity. Old English graf is essentially something dug, a cave or a trench. Again, the description is apt. A tricky trench. Close to the devil's grave is a circular mound, pikelow. Old English pitched, pointed, and Old English floor, mound, and well attested as the most common meaning, artificial mound, burial mound, barrow. What makes pikelow significant, beyond its appearance, is that three parishes and four townships meet at its centre. Boundaries, when first defined, often used visible, well-known aspects of the landscape for reference. Natural features are common, as are pre-existing artificial ones. It's likely that Golden Stone was used because it was already there. Similarly, pikelow was not built as a marker, but was chosen because it was important and beyond dispute. The line was strung between. From Thieves' Hole by Seven Fires and Golden Stone to Stormy Point and Saddle Bowl. We and the farmer are on the last leg of the journey, and it's the most intriguing one. Saddle Bowl, B-O-L-E, is a spur from Stormy Point with a dip the shape of a saddle about halfway along its length. The ridge ends in a convex slope. Old English, saddle. Old English, bol, a smooth, rounded hill. But another etymology for bowl may be better applied to this part of the edge, where copper and lead have been worked from early periods, and amounts of iron, cobalt, antimony, arsenic, manganese, sulfur, silver, mercury, and tin occur. Old English bolla is a round hollow, a bowl, a crucible. Bowl as a mining term is first found in print in Fodinae Regales, or the History, Laws and Places of the Chief Mines and Mineral Works in England, Wales and the Irish Pale, and also of Mint and Money, with a clavis explaining some difficult words relating to mines, etc., by Sir John Pettus Knight, 1670. Sir John was Deputy Governor of the Royal Mines, and his book was the standard treatise of the 17th century. In the clavis, there is the entry, "Bowls or bolsteads are places where, in ancient time, before smelting mills were invented, the miners did fine their lead." An investigation on Saddle Bowl in 2007 produced lead scoria and other smelting waste, together with broken, unburnt lead ore. Future work will show whether or not bowls are present. This part of Saddle Bowl would suggest that they are. The concentration of metals in the soil here prohibits any kind of vegetation. The hill may have had an importance that anachronistic modern thought would miss. The Fodinae Regales is concerned not only with metallurgy, but also with alchemy. And the division between the two was once more permeable than it is today. Saddle Bowl may have been associated with a perception of science amounting to a mystery, to add to its other ancient otherness. At the side of the track along Saddle Bowl, which again is a multiple boundary, between Stormy Point and the saddle, there stands the Rock of the Iron Gates. Now, I have not seen the name identified as being that rock in any written or printed form. How then do I know that it is the Iron Gates of the legend, the way to the sleeping hero? My grandfather told me. And how did he know? Somebody told him, as they too had been told. We are dealing with legend, and legend is belief of truth. It is not fiction, it is not imagination, it is not invention, it is reportage. But why the Iron Gates? A solid rock should not need iron gates. Gate is clear. Old Norse, gata, road or way. Iron, Old English, eirin, is less obvious, but the Peterborough Lapidary of about 1500 has the entry, "Iron is a stone." There was an archaeological excavation of parts of the boundary ridge in 1999. The excavation, though limited, revealed beneath the bank what seems to be an earlier structure consisting of a wall of rubble and masonry, cut stone. And the wall appears to have run as far as Stormy Point. If that was so, it would have been impressive, well deserving the name of Stoneway. If legend is news that time has changed, it could explain why, after the wall was covered with turf and earth, the name was applied to the rock next to it, the significance of Iron and Gata lost. What has not been lost is the importance of the special places, the memory in the markers of the zigzag journey. Yet there are questions to be asked of the legend from the start, which take us beyond physical topography to the numinous. Why was it that the old man stopped the farmer on Thieves' Hole? And what was a farmer travelling from Mobley doing there in the first place? He could not have been on any modern road. No road remains today, yet he was not lost. Recent archaeology has interpreted the ditch as a prehistoric route along the crest of the edge. In the right conditions, the track may be seen as a crop mark heading towards Macclesfield. In the other direction, the track continues past Beacon Mound, the highest point of the edge, across fields, later through grandiose gardens, then as an unbroken series of paths and ways over the fine spot of a Middle Bronze Age pole stave at a boundary brook, by the fringe of the waters of Lindo Moss, with its bog bodies of Iron Age Lindo men, to Mobley Village. But we still have to cope with the old man at Thieves' Hole. Why did he stop the mare here? Today, a farm track crosses the ditch at right angles, filling in the depression. And in the legend, it's here that the old man and the farmer engage. If the track does indeed pass over Thieves' Hole, it should be the later feature. But roads are deceptive in that their function alters through time, which causes changes in size and surface. Should there be a true relationship and intersection, then Thieves' Hole would have formed a crossroad here. And crossroads share the uncertainty and the uncanny with boundaries for the same reason. They are ambivalent. The centre of a crossroad is going nowhere. Just as the centre of Pikelow with its seven joinings occupies nowhere. Such liminal places are where space and time are weakened and other dimensions may break through. That is why I suggest boundaries play so great a part in the legend. I go further and say that if a crossroad did not exist on Thieves' Hole, the old man would not and could not have met the farmer there. In the legend, we're dealing not only with a physical, but also with a spiritual topography. Centres and boundaries are a large part of the structure. They are midpoints or midway lines between opposites. These divisions without dimension symbolise the supernatural in space. The same phenomenon is represented in time as the juncture between years, seasons, days. Each kind of division is occupied by a power which notably, when applied to time, breaks through on November Eve and May Eve in Celtic, that is, Iron Age, culture. They are the hinges of the two great seasons. November Eve, the start of winter and of the year, was a solemn and a weird festival. The mounds were open and their inhabitants were abroad. The barrier separating the living and the dead was breached. And which temporal boundary is the back end of October, when the farmer goes out of his world to the sleeping hero? Consider also how the first meeting with the old man is at the crack of night and day, dawn, and the second, dusk, the moment that was called inter canem et lupum, between the dog and the wolf. Boundaries of territory, as with boundaries of time, are where the supernatural intrudes through the surface of existence. It is why the old man has to meet the farmer at a crossroad, a road without direction or commitment, at a time when time is stopped. Once the farmer turns from his way home, he is entering another reality. The approach to the sleeping hero begins on Thieves' Hole, and with each step, he moves out of his reality into that other. That other may be remembered in the earliest account of the Edge. It's a grant of land dating from the 13th century, which uses the stone or earthen ridge on Saddle Bowl as the boundary. From the content of this document, I see the legend active 800 years ago. All the way markers noted are interesting, but one is more. And from the Picked Law to a Vardis Hatcher. Old English personal name, Alf Werd. Old English hatch, gate. Alf Werd is a personal name, yet I wonder. It consists of two elements, Alf, elf, and in the Middle Ages, elf was no whimsy, but a force, and Werd, ward. I felt that this was too important to risk, so I wrote to one of the most respected of English language scholars, Professor R.W.V. Elliott of the Australian National University. Here's his reply. Avada's Hatch, your suggestion that this is not Alfwerd's gate, but the Elfguard's gate, is perfectly possible. In the West Midlands, the word elf, elves, are recorded as alva, alvan. These words occur several times in Learman's Brut, circa AD 1200. Thus, the gate of the Elfguard is a good West Midland reading and perfect for Alderley. The sleeping hero would correctly be called elf in this context, and the old man his ward. And the gate from Gatta and gate from Hatch may be no more than a happy fluke of convergence. Boundaries can echo Saxon estates, Roman and Iron Age foundations, Bronze Age field systems, even the Neolithic. And some combine all. They are among the longest surviving of our monuments, whether they use artificial structures or natural features, as here, a Mesolithic site and waymarker beyond Avardishatch, where the lip of the rock is in one parish, the path below in another, and the vertical face nowhere. So, where does this take us? The Anglo-Saxons developed an ambivalent attitude towards the spaceless spaces. They feared them, and yet employed them because of their liminality for such purposes as execution. These negative associations came with Christianity. At first, the Anglo-Saxons were in awe of monuments, especially of early Bronze Age round barrows, which they adopted as marker points for the boundaries of their land divisions, intensifying that liminal power. And they reused the barrows, inserting their dead into the realm of the more ancient. Yet these places, dangerous because of their lack of contact with the world, while yet defining it and unknown to God, were chosen as meeting places for assemblies, both political and social, perhaps for that very neutrality where arguments of this world held no sway. Moboli, which means the mound of the assembly, has its church sited on an artificial circular earthwork, which may be the eponymous mound. The change in level of the graves helps to delineate it. From here, Beacon Mound on the edge, skirted by the line of Thieves' Hole, is visible. If there was a connection between the edge and the mound of Moboli, has it been preserved as the route taken by the farmer? And what connection could there have been? I suggest that the links between mounds, Lindo Moss, and hill, together with the zigzag journey, point to a landscape of the sacred, and that the legend records it in memory. It is a memory that covers more than one era. The swing of belief increased the association of ancient burials and boundaries with the uncanny. The no places became synonymous with the supernatural. There, evil was confined until, inter canem et lupum, darkness dissolved the barriers from view. It is clear in Beowulf, which dates from possibly the 7th or 8th centuries. The viewpoint of the poem is Christian, but its material is pagan. Beowulf is a tale bracketed by boundary and barrow. It contains the spatial topography understood by an 8th century mind. Beowulf's first heroic victory is the killing of Grendel, whose epithet is Merkstapa, boundary walker, and his last is in battle with a dragon guarding a treasure in a barrow. Stig undalai eldum uncouth. Men did not know the way to it under the ground, nor did the farmer from Moboli. Barrows, in tradition and in reality, could hold treasure, now called grave goods. And the findings of them during secondary use of the barrow would give an extra bond with the past and add to the otherworldliness of the site. Pyclo may be such. While I was taking photographs to illustrate today's entertainment, my wife, mooching about, picked up a flint arrowhead from the outwash at the base of the mound. Pyklo is almost certainly of the Bronze Age. This flint is the first proven evidence of the Neolithic on the edge, up to 2,000 or years earlier, as opposed to the established Mesolithic spanning 5 millennia before that. The importance of place may reach further than we can ever know. Accounting for that deeper nature of the edge is not easy. The hill has been used since the end of the last ice age, about 10,000 years ago. Worked imported flint and chert, mainly from the Yorkshire Wolds, 100 miles to the northeast, is found here from that time. But the cultures of the Mesolithic and the Neolithic could not be expected to leave much beyond flint and chert. However, by the age of 21, I felt that the legend of Alderley, as told by my grandfather, contained, as it were, a guide to an unrecognized Bronze Age, 4,000 years ago. I was nearly 60 before Persistence won and made the archaeologists look, which justified both grandfather and legend. The edge is the earliest dated site of metalworking in England, and the radiocarbon figure is 4,000 years. Yet, why should archaeology appropriate an almost universal myth and vice versa? I can only proffer cause and reason. The edge is a remarkable thing which stands out when seen both from the plain and from the Pennines to the east. I would say that it is of itself liminal, a temenos, a special, a holy, or a haunted place, provocative of archetypes, dependent on the historical view of the observer. And the colours of its formation are striking. Such details are important at many levels of consciousness. Metallurgy is a magical and dangerous art. Its practitioners are magical and dangerous men. Who else but the rightful king can draw the sword from the stone? Yet it may be that the edge was important before copper was worked or alchemy was born. The edge could have been valued and even revered as a source of pigment. Pigments were traded over distance, and their source was considered to be a place of power, a seat of spirituality. We, as children of the edge, knew where to find our body paint, the green, the red, the blue, the yellow, the white, the black, and how to mix it, though who taught us? In a paste of precious lard or dripping stolen from our mother's jars in World War II. John Hocknell, the mildest of boys, when daubed, became a god. There's more in the legend when we listen, but I'll end at the start. If some supernatural agency has gone to the trouble of creating a cavern beneath the edge this one is man-made from the 19th century, to house an enchanted army against the day of ultimate trial. Why is there the logistical error, the cock-up of being one horse short? Did no one count? And why is that required horse a mare? What is it the sleeping hero needs? Mares weren't used in battle. Stallions were. Why is there a white mare on the edge? What is it this hero lacks? I knew that I knew, but what? And then, of course, I remembered Giraldus Cambrensis. Giraldus wrote in the late 12th century. He starts chapter 25 of the third part of his Topography of Ireland with these words. There are some things that if the urgent demands of my account did not require it, shame would prevent their being described. But the severe discipline of history spares neither truth nor modesty. He then relates a ritual alleged to be used when a king assumes power. At the inauguration, the king, before witness of the people, copulates with a white mare. The mare is then killed. The mare is butchered and boiled. A bath is made for the king from the broth. He sits in the bath and partakes of the meat, and his immediate companions, his knights, if you like, eat also. Then and only then he enters into the kingship. The mare is the complement of his strength, the receptacle of his power. The act is a new creation, a cleansing, a sacrament. Yet, can the ceremony be a survival spanning 3 millennia to Giraldus? I see no reason to reject the thought. As the tribal elder stood his ground in British Columbia, so Australian law has been forced to allow the validity of Aboriginal oral memory beyond historical time. It is our ability to read that inhibits our capacity for retention. Support for a Bronze Age survival in Ireland, and by implication in the legend, comes from Scandinavia. At Bohuslän in Sweden, there is Bronze Age rock art that depicts the copulation that Giraldus describes and resolves the anomaly of Alderley's missing horse with vigour. I set out on a journey to find why my grandfather told me a story. And I've told that journey as a story. With the farmer, it has been a long way to market. I found my answer in the land, because the land itself is a narrative, paths and waymarkers, its stories. The reworking of oral tradition and the reworking of landscape go hand in hand, and the mare and the man are one. Is it coincidence? I think not. The length of a legend is a story told to a child. fragments of timelessness, embodying archaeological and spiritual truths, passed down in the memories of unlettered minds, the importance, if not the meaning and understanding, retained faithfully over 4,000 years to me and to my people. Thank you.